On those hills, before all this was even here? I knew from school they left traces where they had ground acorns into flour on slabs of rock. I love the green hills, he said. But I like them best when they're yellow dry. I like them green, I said, not understanding how anyone could like them when they were dead. We reached the oval and then the Stanford Quadrangle with its covered shaded pathways made of diamonds of cement and alternating earth-toned colors, like a faded Harlequin costume. Want to get on my shoulders? He leaned down and grasped me under my armpits. I was 9 and small for my age, and hoisted me up. His weight tilted and bobbed. We did a loop around the square, under the arches, past the gold numbers on the glass doors. He held my shins in his hands, but let go when he started to lose his balance. He tripped, tripped again, struggling to stay upright. I swayed, terrifyingly high up. And then he fell. On the way down, I worried for myself, for my face and my knees, the parts of me that might hit the pavement. Over time, I learned he would always fall. Still, I let him carry me because it seemed important to him. I felt this like a change of pressure in the air. This was part of his notion of what it meant to be a father and daughter. If I said no, he would retract. We got up and brushed ourselves off. He wound up with a bruise on his butt and a scrape on his hand. I got a skinned knee and headed for the drinking fountain at the side of the quadrangle. It was built into a wall of patterned tiles. From there, I could see the green leaves in another smaller courtyard beyond us, like stained glass. I liked looking at sunlight from the shade, the way it didn't wash all around and blind you, but was a separate glowing thing. We skated farther into the university. The asphalt was rough, full of rocks. Skating over it tickled my throat and my thighs, made a tune play in my bones. We skated uphill past the fountain and the clock, to the metal tables in the courtyard of a Tresidder cafe, where we sat for a moment and drank apple juice. I strummed my legs with the weight of the skates and poked my fingers through the cool metal lattice of the chair. There was an oak above us on a raised part of the courtyard with silver ridges twisting up the trunk and deep grooves with black at their centers. On the way back through the campus, on the sloping downhill on the rough cement, I was a tuning fork for the road, flying out ahead of him. I sang, my throat vibrating with the stones. You're all right, kid, he said, but don't let it go to your head. I won't, I said. I'd never heard the phrase before. Let it go to your head. He pointed out the stained glass and golden tiles, the way the masons had used local sandstone, from the pillars to the big rocks that made up the exterior walls. The stone had thick granules of sand in it. The light gave it dimension, made it look faceted and rough. Some areas had carvings, like the stone was embroidered. Do you think these stonemasons came from other countries to do this? He asked, touching one of the big rectangles tufted out like a pillow. I saw the building the way he did then, just a pile of stones that human hands had carved and placed. I began to see how inside my father there were two competing qualities, one sensitive and specific as a nerve in a tooth, the other unaware, blunt, and bland. Because he noticed the details in care of the craftsmen who built this place, the way they'd chipped at every block and arranged it, I knew he must be capable of noticing other people too, of noticing me. You know, I didn't go to college, he said. Maybe you won't go either. Better just to go out and get into the world. If I didn't go to college, I would be like him. At that moment, I felt like we were the center of the world. He carried it with him, this feeling of center. They teach you how other people think during your most productive years, he said. It kills creativity, makes people into bozos. It made sense to me. Still, I wondered why he always wanted to skate around Stanford, why he seemed to love it, if he didn't believe in it. He's just got a chip on his shoulder, my mother said when I told her we thought college was a waste of time. When we crossed the street, he grabbed my hand. "Do you know why we hold hands?" he asked. "Because we're supposed to?" I hoped he'd reply, "Because I'm your father." Other than these crossings, we didn't hold hands, and I looked forward to it. "Nope," he said. "It's so if a car is about to hit you, I can throw you out of the street." On University Avenue, he pointed to a bum crouched in a nook with a cardboard sign. "That's me in 2 years," he said. A few minutes later, as we got into the residential streets farther away from the main street of the town and closer to my house, he farted. The sound loud and high like a balloon opening, interrupting the silence. He kept skating like nothing happened. When he did it again, I looked away. After the third time, he muttered, "Sorry." "It's okay," I said, mortified for him. When my father and I got back to my block, kids were out playing in the yards and on the sidewalks. Straight across from our house lived a tall, short-haired woman named Jan, whose husband worked at Next. Farther down the long driveway that ran beside Jan's house was the dark wooden house of a woman who dated my father when my mother was pregnant with me, and who was now married and had a baby boy. It was a strange coincidence to move here and find ourselves living on a line with two people connected to my father. My mother said he attracted coincidences in an uncanny way. We stopped on the sidewalk across from our house, and a few men who lived nearby gathered around my father. Three fathers holding three babies. They wanted his opinions, wanted to know what he thought about this or that. The mothers chased after the toddlers to give the fathers a chance to talk. I stood nearby, proud that it was my father they wanted to talk with. They discussed people I'd never heard of and companies I didn't know. Soon, the babies began to fuss, squirming, letting out little cries and yelps. My father continued to talk, hardware, software, the same discussions that seemed to come up over and over with all the men we saw in Palo Alto those days. All three babies began to wail. My father talked as if nothing had changed, and the men tried to listen, bouncing the babies, who wailed louder. He talked louder, faster, so his words got through the noise. His voice was high, loud, and nasal, with sharp points at the end of his phrases that hurt my ears and knifed into my sternum. And I wondered if that's what it was like for the babies who were bawling. The fathers had to stop talking and take them away. Back inside, he and I stood by the radiator and took off our skates, and my mother joined us. My parents liked each other. You could tell. I leaned over to make folds in the legs of my jeans, pulling the extra fabric over itself and rolling it up. This gave the impression of a thinner leg. With my jeans pegged, my proportions were right. I favored a big t-shirt that bagged around my upper body, my legs like sticks poking out. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Pegging my jeans," I said. "Do you think that's cool?" he asked. "Yes, I do." "Oh," he said. Then, in a mocking tone, he said, "Oh, Biff! Oh, Blaine! I hope you like my jeans!" "Steve?" my mother said. She was smiling, but I could tell she didn't like it. "Maybe she'll marry Thad," he said. Dirk, Blaine, Trent, Trav. These were his names for my imaginary future boyfriends and husbands. I was 9, the thought of marriage irrelevant to my life. I laughed to show I knew it was a joke. But I wondered if he picked ugly, truncated names and fretted about my marriage prospects because he thought I was ugly or without promise. "Or maybe you'll marry Christian," he said. Christian lived across the street and was around my age. With blonde hair and gold-rimmed glasses and a trace of an accent from Georgia, where he was from. He wore plaid shorts and t-shirts, and he was skinny, and he did his homework in a tiny scrawl with a mechanical pencil. He also had a single mother. I liked him, but I knew I didn't want him to be my boyfriend. Once a month or so, another boy named Kai, with dark hair, petalite skin, and red lips, would visit his father, who lived in the house beside us. He poked his head up at the window that looked into my bedroom window, a surprise. He was shy and didn't want to play, but his presence gave me such a thrill I thought I might pick him, if I was required to choose a husband. But I didn't say it. "Let me see your teeth," I said to change the subject. "Show me how they come together like a zipper."
"No way," he said,
as if I might be trying to mock him, when I felt only admiration and curiosity. "Please," I said. He leaned down and opened his mouth. No overbite, no underbite, no spaces in between. A mountain range and sky.
"They're amazing," my mother said. "How they come together like that?"
He closed his mouth.
"Let me see yours, Lise," he said.
I showed him.
"Interesting. And yours?"
He looked into my mother's mouth. Her bottom teeth were fine, but crowded, like too many guests mingling in a small room.
"They don't look so great. Might want to see about that," he said,
even though he'd been kind just a moment before. She winced and closed her mouth. It was as if the magnet changed direction suddenly and now they repulsed each other. It was not possible to know in advance when the switch would occur.
"Maybe she'll look like Brooke Shields," he said about me.
"Who's Brooke Shields?" I asked.
"A model," my mother said. "With these really great eyebrows," my father said.
After that, he left, saying something like, "Maybe you will," in a trailing voice across the lawn. He was in stocking feet, carrying his skates over his shoulder. When he left, it was like stepping into a dark room after being in the bright sunlight. It was dim and uniform, washed out with the after image of light. I played the flute. My mother ordered new tropical fish pattern sheets for my bed. My cousin Sarah was coming to visit in a couple months. Before he'd arrived, these things were exciting. But for days after his visits, they didn't seem so important anymore. It would take time to build it all back up again. I saw now in my eyebrows promise. This was around the time my mother would say later that my father fell in love with me.
"He was in awe of you," she said,
"but I don't remember it. I noticed he was around more and grabbed me and tried to pick me up even when I didn't want to be picked up. He had opinions about my clothes and teased me more about whom I would marry."
"I wish you'd been my mother,"
my father said to her, strangely, one afternoon as she was preparing lunch and I was playing. Another time he said,
"You know she's more half me, more than half my genetic material."
The announcement caught my mother off guard. She didn't know how to respond. Maybe he said it because he'd started feeling close to me and wanted a greater share. I remember an abundance of crisp sunlight. Shadows like blotches swaying inside the light, as if there was more sunlight in those days than there is now. We looked for houses we wanted while we skated around. He liked dark wood-shingled ones, vines twisting up the dark brown or grayish face, wood so old it silvered, mullioned windows, small panes of glass, gardens with plants that looked blown into heaps. If you looked in the windows of those houses, you could tell they'd be dark inside. I liked the houses that were painted white, symmetrical, with columns and plain lawns, heavy and sturdy on the land, like banks.
"You gotta stop and smell the roses," he said.
He said it urgently, then stopped and put his nose deep in a rose inside. I didn't have the heart to tell him it was only an expression, but soon I got into it anyway. And we looked for the best rose bushes in the neighborhood, crisscrossing the streets. Roses were plentiful in the yards. I noticed good ones he'd missed behind fences, and we trespassed across lawns on the toes of our skates to get to them. Since Ron was out of the picture and my mom and I were on our own again, I figured it was clear to both of us by now that we didn't want anyone else. We didn't need boyfriends. We were doing pretty great. The new house, my father dropping by.
So it had surprised and infuriated me when she told me about a new man named Elon. Elon would be the one who stuck around the longest, 7 years, and changed my life for the better. But first I would ignore him for 6 months and smirk at him, trying to get him to leave us alone. He had black hair that formed tight ringlet curls around his head, a long face with a large nose, and intelligent brown eyes. He had a PhD in chemistry and founded and ran a small science toy company. I was interested in his stories. He traveled around the world as a boy because his father was a world-renowned Hungarian opera tenor, and he played clever pranks in school. But as I listened, I still noticed with condescension how unglamorous, how nerdy he was compared with my father. He drove an old white VW Rabbit and sometimes pretended he had a car phone, mocking the Silicon Valley types who'd recently bought car phones the size of bricks, miming at stop signs as if he were receiving an important phone call. He had 2 children, a younger son and a daughter around my age named Allegra, with whom I danced to Madonna's Lucky Star at her house one afternoon, when I still thought he and my mother were only friends. He'd had an open marriage, but had fallen in love with my mother against the rules and had separated from his wife. I didn't like the idea. I taunted my mother, but I couldn't irritate her much when she was in love. "He's married," I reminded her. "Oh, honey," she said, like I was a fool. When I was with Elon and my mother together, I felt the grumpy rage I'd felt when she started dating her last 2 boyfriends. "Are you all right, sweetie?" she asked. Being in love made her seem as if she was far above me, looking down, separate. She was unable to keep a slight smile off her lips. With the others, I had still believed my mother and I were a team against them. With Elon, I sensed she might let go of me. Not him, if she had to choose. And I was going to make her choose. I hunkered down for a long campaign. 1 weekend morning, several months after they'd started dating, we walked to breakfast. I complained but went along. We dashed across busy Alma Street to the curb on the other side, through a hole in the fence through the bushes, and onto the elevated mound of white rocks where the train tracks ran. From there, it was a straight walk north for 20 minutes along the rocks and the tracks, balancing on one iron track or stepping between wood planks. We watched for trains. "Look," Elon said as a train came toward us. He placed a penny on the rail before we ran to the side, and the train thundered past. Afterward, the penny was hot and had become a shiny copper disc, an uneven oval. It was an object I would have liked to keep. "Whatever," I muttered when he showed me. It took a lot of energy to despise Elon and my mother continuously, the way I did for months. Around them, I was lethargic, smirked, and was potentially silent when either of them made a joke. When we had dinner with others, I noticed how Elon would find a way to bend the conversation toward his father without quite mentioning him, so that someone else would become curious and ask, "Who was your father?" My cruelty and unhappiness around him felt like a fierce tamping down of myself. It was exhausting and hadn't worked so far to break them up, although it had made them both cautious around me. If I broke out of character for a moment with one thread of happiness, I knew my mother would take it as permission. I refused to give her that. It was as if she'd forgotten what we went through during each breakup, and I hated her for how she was misty-eyed and foolish. The restaurant, MacArthur Park, was in a converted barn and served a fancy buffet brunch with bowls of strawberries, bowls of fresh whipped cream, waffles and eggs and nickel domes, and fresh juice. Usually we went to simpler places. That morning something changed as I stood at the buffet and looked back at my mother and Elon, who were sitting at a round table facing me, smiling. Looking at them, past the piles of fruit and the billows of cream, I felt too weary and too content to stay enraged, and they looked like parents. I surrendered. I felt safe here under the vaulted ceiling, with the clinks of silver-plated serving implements, however awful I had been. They would take me even now, and I could let them if I wished to, and it wasn't too late to have it. A family. When I talked with him much later, when I was an adult, Ilan told me how he'd taken several walks with my father when they happened to see each other at the Rinconada house, encouraging him to spend more time with me, framing parenthood and time spent in terms of personal advantage. "It's for you, Steve," he'd said. Think of it that way. He'd noticed my father was opportunistic. He went for whatever was most appealing in the moment, ignoring me if someone else arrived. Ilan encouraged my father, praising him for even small gestures toward fatherhood. He praised him, for example, when my father took me for a skate. Ilan's work, too, was entrepreneurial and consuming, but my mother said he had the ability to transition from work mode to family mode with ease and speed, so that when he was with us, or with me, having dinner with us as he did most nights before going back to the office, he was focused, not halfway listening, the way a lot of businessmen were. It was Ilan, who, after staying home several nights to help me with my math and science homework, sitting beside me on the couch, patient. Even though he had planned to go back to work in the evening because his company was struggling, gave me the first taste of what it felt like to arrive prepared for class, to understand the lesson and have a homework sheet filled out right. After several nights of his help, I wanted to arrive prepared and to feel the calm and get the attention that came with it. And so it would be Ilan later, who was part of the reason I would start to do well in school. That summer, Ilan's daughter, Allegra, and I went to my father's house in Woodside to go swimming, and afterward we explored the house. She found a room I'd never seen before near the front door. Empty bookshelves covering the walls up to the ceiling, a couple of books and magazines here and there. In the middle of the room was a crude model of the property, with a land made of the crumbly green material used to hold stems in flower arrangements. "Do you think he's ever been in this room?" she asked. "Probably not," I said. We rummaged through the things, which I thought looked as though they might have been left by the people who'd lived here before. High up on a shelf, I found several copies of a Playboy magazine. "Look!" We flipped through it, sitting on the floor. That rumor about my father and Playboy might not have been true. But there, on the next page, was his face. A postage stamp-sized black and white photo above some text. He looked innocent in a white shirt and a bow tie. Fully dressed. "I knew it," I said. "I've heard about this." I was so relieved he was not nude or leering, and I wanted Allegra to notice him. I felt lucky to have a father like that. We turned the page. A naked woman was sprawled out across two pages, a brunette with big hair, bedroom eyes, red lipstick. On one of our skating outings that year, my father and I stopped at a low building nestled in trees near downtown. We each had one mildly skinned knee from another fall. "I know some people here," he said. "It's a design company." We didn't remove our skates. Inside, it was carpeted, so we could walk almost normally. We went down the hallway and into a room with a large table lit up with fluorescent lights, with pages of white paper fanned out on top, messy. "Do you know what a serif is?" he asked. "No," I said. I wished he'd given me the context. I wanted to impress him. Maybe he wanted to impress me by teaching me something. He pointed to a page with black letters. "Look," he said. "An S?" "No," he said. He pointed to a T, the top right side, where the letter curved down. "See the lines around the letter?" he asked. "There's a small line at the end of the long one. That's a serif. Some people think you can read better with them." His voice was urgent. I gathered that serifs were very important. "Look here," he said, pointing at others. "Here, and here, and here." The serifs became visible, separated from the letters. Caps and tails. Flips you might make with your pen at the end of the word if you didn't lift it off the paper. Seraphs had always been there, but now I could name them. Feet are like seraphs of the legs, I thought later. Toes are seraphs of the feet. Of all the details on the planet, he wanted to show me this. He pointed to other fonts. The serifs were different between fonts, longer, shorter, thicker, thinner. They reminded me of notched branches in the spring, tendrils that might grow out and later become letters themselves.
Bauer Bodoni, he said, and Times New Roman, and Garamond.
He pointed to a blunt-edged font and asked me what that was called.
Not serifs?
There's a word in Latin that means without, he said. He paused. Was I supposed to know Latin?
It's sans, he said.
So they're called sans, I said.
Sans serif, like these, he said, pointing.
Another S, but S. Letters without serifs looked naked now. My mother liked letters plain and fine. She liked them thin. He liked them thick. In my adult life, I would work at a science lab, a bank, a study abroad office, a restaurant, a cosmetics company, a design company. There are codes and marks for each, different languages to describe beauty and importance. I could not be a full member of every group. I would have to pick.
So, have you kissed anybody yet?
He asked me on the skate home. He meant French.
No, yuck.
When did you have your first kiss?
I was around your age, he said.
Who'd you kiss?
Her name was Deirdre Lupoletti.
Like loopy spaghetti confetti? It was too perfect.
She had brown hair down to here, he said, motioning to his butt. We kissed in the basement at her parents' house. Actually, she was the one who kissed me.
I wished for his story, not mine, and for his confidence. A story with a name like that. I was already behind. If he'd kissed by my age, I should have kissed too. My cousin Sarah came to visit. She was my mother's older sister, Kathy's daughter, and our only relative around my age. Soon after I was born, we lived with her and her parents for a few months in Idlewild, California. Now, Sarah was tall but stooped. She spoke sharply and sometimes too loud and piercingly for indoor spaces. She was the only child I knew who could be wry, as if she was already life-weary. There was something else about her, maybe wit or irony, that she possessed despite her too bold voice and jolting movements and her seeming unawareness of her surroundings, a mature perception that meant she was both a child and at the same time watching from a distance. I'd been looking forward to the visit for months. She'd never met my father. And tonight, we would all have dinner together at Bravo Fono in Stanford Shopping Center. When we played together as children, neither of us had a father around. Now I did, and I wanted her to see what it was like. He'd picked the place. He was late. He was always late. When he walked in, I could sense he was not happy. It hadn't been a good day at work, maybe. His angles were wrong. He didn't want to be here. His mood was like black soot in the air. My mother ordered the bib lettuce salad. I ordered the linguine with shrimp. We were careful about what we ordered around him. He disapproved of meat. His dietary code didn't have to do with animal welfare, but with aesthetics and bodily purity. Later, when he looked at people with his particular disdain, I could see what made them foolish in his eyes. Their complete unconsciousness of how ignorant they were, picking at their dead food. There was a thin line between civility and cruelty in him, between what did and did not set him off. I knew he wouldn't like the idea of the shrimp. I also knew it would pass, but we'd forgotten to warn Sarah. "I'll have the hamburger," she said, too loud. I wanted to muffle her to protect her, and to protect myself. The trick, I learned later, was to give him less surface area to knife, so he would stab someone else. Always someone, if not me. The food arrived. I hope Sarah wouldn't feel the tense static in the air or notice that my father hadn't said a word to her yet and glanced at her dish with disgust. She talked too loud for the echoing, semi-empty restaurant with all its walls of windows, glass bricks, and stone floor. I didn't know how to tell her to talk more softly. After we'd taken a few bites, my father's face shifted and tightened.
"What's wrong with you?"
he asked Sarah.
"What?"
she said. She was chewing on a bite of meat.
"No," he said. "Really?"
At first it seemed that he was asking her to answer him. What was wrong with her? Why did she miss social cues? Why did she have such a biting high voice at the top of the register, always calling for attention, as acute as a baby crying? His voice became high-pitched and piercing.
"You can't even talk," he said. "You can't even eat. You're eating shit."
She looked at him. I could tell she was trying not to cry.
"Have you ever thought about how awful your voice is?" he continued. "Please stop talking in that awful voice."
I couldn't believe it was happening, even as it was happening.
"Steve, stop it right now," my mother said.
I could see him through Sarah's eyes. Or I thought I could. If having a father around was like this, it wasn't so great.
"I wish I wasn't here with you," he said. "I don't want to spend another moment of my life with you. Get yourself together. Pull yourself together."
He talked loud enough so the people at other tables could hear him. Sarah slouched in her chair and looked at the table and began to cry.
"Steve," my mother said, "stop." "You should really consider what's wrong with yourself and try to fix it," he said.
He got up and walked toward the bathroom. We leaned in and flanked Sarah so that no one else could watch. I was aware of the tables beside us and what they could hear and what they thought and how people sat beside violence and were not really a part of it. Sarah was sobbing messily with snot and tears, wiping her nose on the back of her sleeve and telling us she was fine. I was smaller than she was, shorter, slighter, but she was small too. "He's a mean person," I said in the parking lot on the way to the car. "It has nothing to do with you." My mother had told me that last part before, when he'd hurt me.
"I know,"
she said. I couldn't tell if she did know or she was just saying it so I would stop comforting her. But she looked at me and said it again. "I know." My father's girlfriend Tina's hair was long and light blonde, the color of the hottest part of the flame. The same hair, the same person, I realized later, who was in his bed the night I thought the blonde man had kidnapped and killed him. I don't remember when I met Tina, but maybe it was one day in the kitchen at my father's Woodside house, where my mother and I had come for lunch. The people my father hired to make the beds and make his salads had made fresh whole wheat pasta, the machine still attached to the side of the kitchen counter, the pasta ribbons flowered and long on a tray. My father and a few others were playing with a toy, rolling it across the kitchen island, a small silver-painted plastic robot figure with a red helmet that rolled with one wheel between its fused legs, and as it rolled, from a dark round hole in the chest cavity where its heart might have been, sparks shot out. I wanted to try it. Tina noticed me watching and called out to them,
"Why don't you let Lisa have it?"
Her thick bangs were feathered on both sides. She had a smooth, low voice and a kind face. My father kept rolling it, swiping his finger in front of the sparks. But then he handed it to me and said ceremoniously,
"A gift. You have it."
Tina and my father had met several years before, when she was working at the philanthropic wing of Apple, and my father was still living at the house in Monte Sereno where we'd taken the couch. She was a software engineer, warm, an introvert. Her beauty was something she shied away from, as if she didn't want it or care for it. And so it wasn't notable to me, even years later, because she didn't foster it or nudge it forward with affectations, makeup, or fancy clothing. She was just Tina. There was a group of good people that hung around Tina, family and friends, artists and scientists, who, like her, took an interest in me and my mother, so that during the years that she and my father were together, I felt there was an extra layer of protection around my mother, my father, and me. She told me years later that my father insisted, persuasively, when they first met, that I wasn't really his kid. When she saw me, it was obvious that I was, but when she brought it up, he refused to discuss it. My father invited me to come on a vacation to Hawaii with the two of them. I was in the fourth grade, almost 10. My mother and I didn't go on vacations, so I wasn't sure what to expect. When we arrived on the tarmac, the sky was bright white. The airport buildings were not enclosed, but outside with wide brown roofs, humidity blurring the line between my skin and the air. A man wearing a polo shirt gave us each a long necklace made of many sweet-smelling hot pink blossoms with yellow centers, and we followed him to a white van. On the drive, there were only miles of charred black land, and I worried he was taking us to a moonscape only he thought was beautiful. But then we took a left toward the ocean and a circle of green. The grass at the resort was mown short as bays and dotted with shade from palm trees with long, thin trunks like strings. At breakfast, brown birds the size of my fist chirped in the high rafters and dropped down onto each just vacant table, messy with napkins, syrup, and bitten pieces of toast. They hopped and picked at crumbs and squabbled until a waiter came to clear, and they rose back up in unison to wait for another. Beside the pool, I watched a peacock fan out, quivering, cawing. It stood still for a while, and then strode away, still fanned out, in slow, methodical steps that made the whole semicircle of plumage sway. That week, I walked barefoot along the sand paths, the warmth rising up through my calves to my knees. After a few days, the dark hairs on my arms became blonde to the roots. In the ocean, the grains of sand and the yellow fish that were strummed up in the shallow waves were bright and clear, magnified by the water. Before this trip, I'd never heard of virgin piña coladas. Now, I had at least three a day. I made a friend around my age named Lauren, who also lived in California. And together we ran between lawns, meals, pools, beaches, the black-lipped fish, the one black swan, the birds and geckos. In the gift shop were cuff bracelets an inch wide, each made of a single piece of koa wood polished to a glow. "Let's pick one out for your mother and Tina," my father said. They clacked against each other on the rail. I wanted a bracelet too, but my hands and wrists were too small. He bought me a bikini made of red cotton with a flower pattern. I'd never worn a bikini before. My new friend Lauren had a similar one, also from the gift shop, but in blue. Tina wore jeans and t-shirts and China flats. She had wide wrists and large breasts and crunched down on her heels when she was speaking with me so we were closer to the same height. She laughed in a full way, and it made her whole face pretty. Her nose was like my mother's, straight and small, with a pointed end that veered slightly to one side. She cut her own bangs. Tina had a happy-sad quality and dry, self-deprecating humor. She was delighted by me. She liked me, I could tell. To me, she seemed like she was a woman, but also a little girl, or could remember so clearly what it was like to be my age that there wasn't such a distance between us. When we were back in Palo Alto and we went somewhere all together in my father's Porsche, she would squeeze her tall body in the back so I could sit up front with him. She was a strange combination with my father, I could tell even then. He would often become grandiose about himself, leaving behind the part of him that matched with her. "She could wear a sack, a brown sack," I heard my father say, as if beauty was measured by how strong an obstacle it had to overcome. It was the same way he spoke about Ingrid Bergman. I watched for it in Tina, because I didn't think of her as particularly beautiful. Her eyelashes were as blonde as her hair. She didn't try, and the trying was beauty to me then. But a few times when she tossed her bangs out of her face, her eyes shone in the sunlight, the color of the swimming pool, and her face opened up, beautiful, until she looked down and adjusted her bangs and looked ordinary to me again. On the way to dinner on the white sand path that wound through the forest, Tina and I flanking him, he put an arm around us both. A hand around my ribs, under my armpit. "These are the women of my life." He said it in a slow, measured, nasal voice, like he was announcing a new act at a show. He looked up and out as he said it, addressing the statement to the forest. I was one of his women. It filled me up with such a surge of joy I had to look away, look down at the path, at my bare feet, so he wouldn't see I was smiling. He leaned toward Tina to kiss her, and the arm he had around me yanked up as he leaned, so that he clawed under my armpit, fingers jerking with his steps. I wanted to stay within his grasp, to be one of his women. "Isn't she beautiful?" he said at dinner when Tina got up to go to the bathroom. Whenever he and I were alone for a moment, he talked to me about her beauty, sighing as if she were far away or it was out of reach. When she returned, he leaned forward and kissed her, murmuring and whispering in her ear. She demurred. He grabbed the back of her head, his chair balanced on one leg. As they kissed, he pressed his palm against her breast, wrinkling the fabric of her t-shirt. "Mmm," he said. I was simultaneously repulsed and intrigued. I guess my role was to watch and note how much he adored her, even though it gave me a strange feeling to be near them when they did this. The act was exaggerated like a performance. It did not seem natural or real. Why didn't she stop him? Maybe because she was very young and in love. "Why did you two make out in front of me?" I asked Tina at some point much later. "It's what he did when he was uncomfortable," she said. "He was uncomfortable around you because he didn't know how to relate to you," she said. "The charm that worked on adults didn't work on you, a child. You saw through it. So he would lunge toward me to ease his own discomfort." The idea that my presence was the very thing that made him seem to be unaware of me was almost inconceivable, because in those moments I felt like nothing. A speck, not worth a look. It was so extreme, Tina said, that when we returned from Hawaii, she decided not to come over when I was around so that he might learn how to be with me on his own. Mona and my mother had also noticed the way my father made out with Tina, sometimes for minutes at a time, moaning. It wasn't just me. He did it in front of adults, too. But I was a child, and this behavior was inappropriate. My mother and Mona were concerned about his jokes and public displays, and this had been, in part, the impetus for Mona's insistence, not long after we returned from Hawaii, that as the child of a single mother without a continuous fatherly presence, it would be a good idea if I saw a male psychiatrist in order to have the experience of forming a close relationship with a good and stable man. My mother agreed it was a good idea. And my father agreed to pay. My mother drove me to meet Dr. Lake, a therapist, recommended by Mona's in New York, whom I would continue to see once per week starting at age 9 for many years. My memory became clear after I started seeing him, perhaps because I was older, or because during our weekly sessions I tried to put my life into words. When he was done kissing Tina, my father righted his chair, sighed, and ate. "You know," he said, "Tina was on television once, in a commercial, when she was a girl, younger than you." I was impressed. Later, my father played it for me. A blonde girl standing beside a boy who opens his fist onto the counter of a beach shop, releasing pocket change and a marble to pay for a box of Cracker Jack. After dessert, he took Tina's hand and looked at her palm. I don't know what the lines are supposed to mean, he said.
I'm not sure either, Tina said. If only we could tell our futures.
I know how to read them, I said to my father. Give me your right hand.
How about the left, he said, because it was closer.
No, that's the destiny you were given. I want to see the right one, what you will make of it.
Okay, he said and stretched it across his body. His palms were flat, without the knuckle hills that poked up around the finger joints, a quality my mother and I had talked about along with others, like the zipper teeth. The inside of his palms glowed pale yellow, the lines deep orange. He ate and drank carrot salad and carrot juice, the color of wet clay on the hillsides in such great quantities they tinted him from the inside out.
So this one's your lifeline, I said, and this one's your mind. This one's your marriage, and this one's your heart, see?
Okay, so what does it mean? He said.
The line curved from below his index finger to his wrist.
It's a pretty long life, I said. But your mind line isn't long. See, it's here. It cracks, splits open.
I was predicting what I knew he'd like the least, to live a long and intellectually middling life. It would puncture his arrogance, the way he seemed magnanimous but disconnected. His feeling of his own tragic greatness so strong he had less energy to notice others. I knew he wouldn't be aware that I already knew this about him, because every time he told me a story about himself and what he wanted, he'd forget he'd told me before. He wouldn't know that I understood he was sad to die young, but he also found it glamorous.
All right, he said,
and pulled back his hand. Tina sat still while my friend Lauren and I French braided her hair beside the pool. Lauren showed me how to save hair as we wove down the nape of her neck. After we were done, my father pulled me onto his lap. He was sitting on a lounge chair and Tina was sitting beside us on another. He told Lauren he wanted some time alone with us, and she left to find her family. I wanted to play, but he held me.
Look how we both have eyebrows that come together in the middle, he said. And how we have the same nose.
He ran his index finger down the bridge of my nose.
No, we don't, I said. Mine's smaller. Mine doesn't point down like that.
Just wait, he said. It will.
Like he knew the future. He grabbed my ankle and held it in his hand, inspecting my foot.
Looks like your second toe might become longer than your big toe, he said.
It's a sign of intelligence, he said, to have the longer second toe.
Maybe yours will grow if you're lucky.
Ha, I said, as if I didn't care.
Uh-oh, Tina said, looking at her foot on the ground. I could tell she was joking.
Did you know I've got narrow feet? He said. It looks like you do, too. And look at your fingers. They're like mine, too. Our nails are shaped the same.
We held out our hands. I couldn't tell about the nails. Mine were so much smaller that it seemed impossible to compare. My heart beat like a bird's heart, quick and light in my chest. It was what I wanted. All his attention focused on me all at once.
You're my kid, you know, he said,
holding me even though he'd stopped looking. I know, I said. I wasn't sure why he said it. He stopped speaking but kept his hold. I was hoping the moment would end, the heavy, oppressive feeling of being held like that.
Let's just sit here, he said. Let's all just be quiet for a minute and sit here.
His arm was like a seatbelt around my waist.
Lise, you're going to remember this, he said, full of feeling.
I sat still, hardly breathing, hoping it would be enough and he'd let me go. Lunch was being laid out, vats of fresh salads and fish, avocado, grapefruit, crab claws on ice, a separate table just for cakes. Finally, he said,
"Let's get lunch,"
and released me. I took a huge breath and a running leap. They lingered behind, walking slowly toward me and lunch. After dinner that night, we walked back to our thatched huts, called Hales, on the white sand path. The tiki lanterns along the path flickered and cast patterns of light, and in pockets, the sour kerosene burned my nostrils. Geckos chirped like metal birds, wound around the poles of black light stuck in the ground, and spun away when I tried to touch them. The forest was thick with veined, waxy leaves wrapped around other leaves. The fragrance was stronger at night, sweet and cool, as if the flowers were exhaling. The air smelled of flowers, decay, and salt.
"Steve's taking us out to breakfast at Late for the Train," my mother said. It was almost the end of my fourth grade year.
"Just us three?"
It was unusual now that Tina and Elon were around for the three of us to eat together.
"Yep."
The restaurant was nestled up against the train tracks at the Menlo Park station. When a train came through every half hour, it was hard to hear anyone speaking, even those at the same table, but the clanking, deafening noise was part of the experience. The owners were a husband and wife, the curtains were lace, and the place smelled of the buttery whole wheat scones they delivered to tables in baskets inside patterned napkins. Before the food arrived, after we'd received our goblets of fresh-squeezed orange juice, my father raised his glass.
"A toast," he said. "You're going to a new school. You got in."
My mother smiled. She was in on it, I realized. I burst into tears. I would have to leave my friends again? Nueva was a private school in an old Crocker mansion on 33 acres of land in Hillsborough that I'd visited for 3 days a few months before. The school was founded for young musicians and allowed students to leave class for private music lessons. It was meant to be a school for the gifted. I'd visited the classroom of a teacher named Bryna, who played the guitar and ended the days in a group rendition of a song about a man named Charlie, who couldn't get off the subway and never returned home. The school was made of gray stone, with balustrades and huge trees. During my 3-day application visit, I went each day to the school-wide 30-minute morning sing in a room called the ballroom, with high curved windows looking out to lawns and forests. I didn't know any of the songs, but I let them wash over me, including one called Russian Picnic with multiple parts. All the students in every grade sat on the floor and sang. I learned later that Elon had resisted the idea of private school. Like Ron, he believed private school was elitist and advised my mother not to send me. But my mother decided not to follow his advice. A few months before, my father had asked my mother angrily, "What happened to her?" He'd noticed I wasn't able to do my current events homework, she said.
"See, I told you so."
She said my eyes had become duller. Before this, she'd asked him to pay for private school, but he'd said no, not wanting me to move schools again. Now he made her promise that if he paid the tuition and they moved me to Nueva, she wouldn't change schools again. My mother had pulled me out of speech therapy lessons a month or two before.
"Why should she take speech therapy?"
my mother asked, when the lessons had been proposed at the start of fourth grade.
"For her lisp, so it doesn't bother other people," the woman answered.
My mother didn't like the answer. She liked my lisp anyway, but she thought I might enjoy the one-on-one instruction. She came to pick me up one day and looked at the textbooks meant to teach the S and TH sounds. They were inaccurate and uninspired, she said.
"Lisa's applying to Nueva," she told the tutor, a woman I seemed to like.
"Would you be willing to write her a recommendation?"
"She's not smart enough," the tutor said.
At school, when they did the homework check, calling out our names to verify if we'd put our homework in the basket, I learned I could just say yes, even though I hadn't. And so far, no one had bothered me. We'd applied to Nueva in the middle of that year, and I understood I wasn't admitted because there wasn't space. Later, I learned it was not only space, but also my IQ, which was much lower than it had been when I tested in kindergarten. My mother said that the principal of the school had lectured them, asking them what schools they'd been putting me in and why they'd let me move schools so many times.
Mona wrote a recommendation letter. My father asked, uncharacteristically, if he could contribute money to get me in. I didn't know this then, but the principal said no. It was school policy in any case to allow all applicants to do a 3-day visit. After the visit to her classroom, Bryna, one of the most respected teachers at the school, wrote a 5-page letter to recommend me, my mother said, and another girl dropped out, and I was admitted. I don't know what I'd done to impress her, and I never saw the letter. They wanted me to start soon, right away, at the end of 4th grade. For the long drive to Nueva, my father bought us a new car, an Audi Quattro. My mother and I went to the lot and chose the maroon model with a light gray leather interior. Under the emergency brake was a stitched leather skirt that bagged loose, like elephant skin. On the dash in front of the passenger seat was a glossy panel of wood. "Now I can knock on wood when I'm driving," my mother said. She knocked to unjinx. She would knock when she saw an odd number of ravens or a black cat wander across our path. She noticed signs and premonitions and would sometimes become despondent if she saw the wrong number of birds, until she saw another bird that changed the count. In the mornings, we drove north down Highway 280 past the reservoir. The drive to Nueva was about 40 minutes. There were birds in the rumpled hills around the freeway, turkey vultures, sometimes eagles and hawks. "How fast do you think we're going?" she asked, covering the speedometer with her hand. 50? In the old Honda, we would have had to yell to be heard. Inside the Audi, it seemed like we were hardly moving. Nothing vibrated or rasped. She removed her hand. 80, she said. "My God!" and braked. My mother learned about a new kind of braces made of a bone-colored polymer to blend in more effectively with the color of teeth. She asked my father to pay for them, and he'd agreed. But the coffee she drank every day discolored the clear bands that surrounded the bone-colored cabooses, browning the bands after just a few sips, making her teeth look yellow. "I'm going to quit coffee," she said. The next day, she had espresso breath, the bands were stained, and she was despondent as she cooked dinner. "Quitting is harder than it seems," she said when I asked her about it. When she smiled, her lips got caught and bunched above them. At a shop, a woman said, "I can't believe you're willing to wear braces at your age." She came home, moved around the house in a jerky, angry way, dislodging papers from her desk. Soon she learned how to change the bands herself. She ordered bags of extra bands and did it every day, crouching with a knee up on the toilet seat, cutting the old ones out with a silver X-Acto knife into which she'd inserted a new sharp blade. It made a sound like flick, 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 as the old bands were spliced and flew across the bathroom. She pulled the fresh bands open with her index fingers, releasing them over each brace. Mona stopped by one day, and she and my mother stood talking in the kitchen near the microwave. My mother was worried the house was too small for a studio. "Just paint," Mona said. "Bedroom be damned. Make it into a studio and sleep in it." Mona had just returned from a residency at an artist's colony called Gerasi. After that, my mother taped up black and white photocopies of the etchings and lithographs of Picasso, Kirchner, Cezanne, Chagall, and Kandinsky from the 1920s and 30s, until her bedroom wall was completely covered in overlapping pages taped at the tops, free at the bottom like tiles or scales that lifted and fell in the breezes. Soon, she also converted the garage into a studio, adding sheetrock to the walls. In my mother's final semester at school, in addition to creating lithograph prints, she started making stencils. She hand-cut the patterns in vellum paper, but later she planned to have them laser-cut for mass production and to sell them as a part of a kit. "This is going to work," she said. "How could it not?" She'd seen a stencil of flowers around someone's living room that struck her as twee. If a person can make money doing something like that, I can certainly make money doing something much more beautiful. She'd created birds for children's rooms based on Audubon's drawings, using multiple anatomically correct stencils and overlapping layers. Around this time, we became friends with a family that moved in across the street. The mother was named Lee.